You're listening to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, episode 118. Welcome to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, where we bring you engaging conversations about wildlife and conservation issues from all across the globe. I'm your host, Matt Podolsky. Today's guest on the show is Rosalyn LaPierre. Rosalyn is an environmental historian, ethnobotanist, and indigenous writer. She is a professor of environmental studies at the University of Montana, a research associate at the National Museum of National History, and is currently a visiting professor of women's studies, environmental studies, and Native American religion at the Harvard Divinity School at Harvard University. She is an enrolled member of the Blackfeet tribe and also identifies as Métis. Rosalyn is also on the steering committee for the March for Science, and has been involved in the March for Science since the birth of this concept shortly after the Women's March and President Trump's inauguration. The March for Science will be taking place this coming Saturday, April 22nd, Earth Day, and although the main event will be taking place in Washington, D.C., there are hundreds of satellite events happening all around the globe, providing ample opportunity for folks to participate. We are actually launching a new experiment here at the Eyes on Conservation podcast that is connected to the upcoming March for Science. We will be covering the march from a variety of perspectives this coming Saturday. We have 7 Wildlands correspondents involved in this little experiment, and each of them will be attending a different March for Science event. These correspondents will be capturing audio to use for an upcoming episode of the podcast, as well as video footage for a potential short film. A select few will be streaming live video from the marches directly to our Eyes on Conservation Facebook page. So if you're not able to attend a March for Science event, or if you just want to get a feel for what some of the larger events in Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, or San Francisco might look like, stay tuned to our Eyes on Conservation Facebook feed to get live updates. In the meantime, we hope that you will enjoy today's conversation with Rosalyn LaPierre, in which we'll explore some of the connections between science, Native American religion, and the environmental movement.
My name is Rosalyn LaPierre, and I am an associate professor of environmental studies at the University of Montana. However, this year, I am a visiting professor at the Harvard Divinity School. That's part of a fellowship that is part of the Women's Studies in Religion program.
Tell me a little bit about your field of study. What specifically about you, that interest of yours, this research interest of yours, you know, brought you from Montana to the Harvard Divinity School?
So I have 3 degrees. My undergraduate degree is in physics. So my initial training as a scholar began with my bachelor's degree when I was very interested in the scientific endeavor. I moved away from that and got a master's degree in religion. And then I moved away from that and got a PhD in environmental history. But actually all 3 of those are quite interconnected. And so the research that I do in indigenous communities is trying to address their view, and I am indigenous, so our view of the natural world. And I believe that our view of the natural world is at this intersection of natural science from a Western perspective and also religion and religious aspects of how Native Americans view the natural world and the supernatural world. So I'm really interested really at this, again, this intersection between traditional ecological knowledge and also religious studies and religious history.
I love this sort of conceptual idea that there is a lot of crossover between this Western idea of science and the belief system, the religious belief systems of indigenous communities. Let's explore this a little bit more. I mean, how do you see these 2 ideas interacting, you know, within the context of your you know, your area of study? Because I mean, I think that, I mean, you say that there is a lot of crossover, and that this is sort of like a natural merging of these two fields. But I think most people would look at these two ideas and think of them as very different, you know, and conflicting.
I think that in Indigenous communities, you need to remember that, or we need to remember that people have been observing, right, the natural world for millennia. And so they always began with an understanding that I would argue is a scientific understanding, right, based on observation, based on experimentation of the environment around them, right, whether they're interacting with the plant kingdom or the animal kingdom, or other parts of the environment. There was an effort to actually observe, experiment, understand, dissect, et cetera, the natural world. So they always came at the natural world, on the one hand, from a natural science perspective. On the other hand of that, they also had their own cosmology and their own worldview. And unlike our understanding in America, where we have this separation, right, of church and state, that never really occurred in most Indigenous communities. They did not separate out what we would consider sort of the scientific slash academic understanding of something versus the religious aspect of something. So they always kept those two things integrated. So I'm interested in looking at how that continues to be reflected in Indigenous communities today, but also looking to the past and looking at how people interacted with their environment and understood their environment to be something different than what we would view it today.
You know, if you look at the history of, you know, Western science and Western religion, they are interconnected, right? And I mean, a lot of early, you know, scientific research was done within the context of a certain base level, you know, religious belief system behind that and backing that. So, I mean, I think there's definitely is like some similarities between like this Western conception of sort of how science and religion interact and that of Indigenous communities. But I mean, one of the other things that I just kind of want to touch on is, you know, the differences between different Indigenous and American Indian cultures. All of those cultures often get grouped together, but, you know, there's so much diversity of different cultures. So, I mean, I guess I'm wondering, like, what specific cultures, like, you study and to kind of put that into context, what specific cultures are you referencing when you talk about these connections between science and religion?
Right, absolutely. So there is a wide diversity of Indigenous community worldwide, but definitely Native American tribes in the United States or in North America. And a lot of times the way tribes were different from each other was based on the environments that they came from, the environments that they grew out of. And so one of the things I'm interested in is primarily an area called the Northern Great Plains. So the Northern Great Plains is an area of North America that today consists of most of Montana, most of North Dakota, the southern part of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. So that sort of middle area of North America. And really what it is, it's the watershed of the Missouri River. So that kind of whole landscape where the water is flowing into the Missouri River, which then, of course, flows south. So within that region, even though it's kind of a large, what we'd call eco-region, it actually, out of that area, grew a diversity of Native people who interacted with the same exact environment in different ways. And they had different types of communities and cultures that grew out of that, but they also had different religious beliefs. So, for example, right now I'm teaching a class at the Harvard Divinity School to graduate students on the Native, it's called Nature and Native Americans, and it's looking at these differences. And one of the questions I am asking them is to look at a particular ecoregion and look at the differences between the people that are there. So, for example, in the Northern Great Plains, I will only name three, but there are several tribal groups that are there. So, for example, in that area, we have the Ojibwe, who grew out of the Great Lakes area, and then through their own individual growth as a tribe and kind of this diaspora, they kind of moved out in many different areas of North America. And actually, the Ojibwe are one of the largest tribes in North America. But they are now out in the Northern Great Plains. So they began as a tribe that was a Great Lakes tribe, so that their culture was centered on being people that lived in a wetter environment, who were both people who had villages and were hunter-gatherers, and then they move out to the Northern Great Plains and they become buffalo hunters, right? So they adapted to a new area, but when they moved there, they took the same religion that had been developed in the Great Lakes area out onto the Great Plains. Another tribe that had been there for quite some time is the Hidatsa. The Hidatsa live on the Missouri River. They are a people who are agricultural people. They subsisted primarily on corn, beans, and squash and sunflowers. And they were people that were settled in place. They also did hunt, but basically their entire subsistence and lifestyle was based on agriculture. And again, because of that, they have a different religious system that grew out of that. And then we have a third tribe, the Blackfeet, who are primarily a hunter and gatherer culture that their entire lifestyle was around hunting bison. And they had a lifestyle where they lived in villages half of the year, and then the other half of the year they were nomadic because they were hunting and they were gathering out on the plains. And by nomadic, I don't mean that they were, you know, kind of willy-nilly just kind of following the bison, which is kind of a common stereotype. They were going to places that they had always gone to, places that they had already manipulated for use, places where they changed the landscape so that bison would come to those places, places where they changed the landscape in terms of wild plant use. And they also developed a completely different religious and system and a cosmology. So it's very interesting how you can find several different tribes living in the same area who have one very different lifestyles, but also then very different religious systems that grow out of that place. And part of it has to do with the way that they are interacting with nature and the natural world in completely different ways. So that's one of the things that we discuss in the class that I'm teaching right now at Harvard, and looking at how people interact with both the natural world as it exists, but also how there are places that are separate, places that are sacred, that have their own basic time and space. And how do people interact with those places as well?
So this past year feels like a really important milestone, you know, specifically for the tribes of the Northern Great Plains because of what happened at Standing Rock. And you've done some writing about Standing Rock and what happened there and what is happening there. I mean, I guess I just wonder generally, like, what your perspective is on the significance of this event.
So, yeah, so Standing Rock also, is smack dab in the middle of the Northern Great Plains along the Missouri River. And, you know, it's a complicated story and it's a complicated situation. It began as a situation where the tribe was interested in addressing the environmental concerns that they had, and they were interested in having a full EIS, which is an environmental impact statement. And environmental impact statements are usually done by scientists and scholars. And so essentially what the tribe was asking for was they were asking for scientists and scholars to step into this situation and provide them with a written document, an EIS, but to provide them with data on what they thought the impact was going to be. So on the one hand, they were looking at folks like hydrologists who, you know, address water quality and water pollution. And on the other hand, they were also interested in having people like archaeologists and cultural anthropologists who are interested in addressing issues like sacred places, sacred sites, and or sites that have human remains. And so the tribe started out with this call to have an EIS, to have scientific, the scientific community come in and again, provide them with information, to provide them with data on how they could address their own concerns. Well, that, as you know, as everybody knows, it went from asking for an EIS, going to court several times, losing every single time in court, to there being a large protest there. And the protest, again, was had two parts to it. On the one hand, people were protesting for the tribe to be able to collect information, right, to get an EIS or to collect information about the environment, potential environmental impact of this pipeline. On the other half, which is was also would have been addressed in the EIS, the other half of that story was that people were interested in trying to protect an area that the tribe viewed as sacred to them, as significant to them. And so because of that, there ended up, again, as everybody knows, a very large protest that lasted for months on end into the middle of winter. And it really wasn't until the new administration came in January that that changed. But I think one of the things that I tried to address in a few of the commentaries that I wrote was sharing what I know about Native American religion. And again, this intersection, right, between religious understanding of the natural world or religious understanding of the landscape intersecting with the Western scientific ideas about the same place, the same, you know, natural science. So I tried to address that in a couple of commentaries to share with people why understanding religion was at the center of also addressing this pipeline protest.
And I think that's really important. I spent just a few days at Standing Rock covering what was going on for our podcast show. And, you know, one of the things that really struck me during the few days that I spent there was the Native American people who were there, they would correct people. There were things that a lot of the white folks who were there, and there were a lot of them, right? I mean, I think at least at the time when I was there, which was, you know, close to sort of, you know, peak level of as far as the numbers of people at the protest, there were obviously a lot of Native American people there. But I mean, it felt like the majority of the people were white folks who were there to support what was going on. And there was a lot of just sort of sharing of knowledge, right? And like, numerous times I saw people, and this happened to me a couple of times, like do something that was, you know, culturally inappropriate, right? And like immediately I was corrected, you know, but not in, you know, in a very sort of friendly way, like a respectful, like I'm sharing this knowledge with you kind of a way, right? But I mean, that wasn't happening for people who weren't physically there, right? And that wasn't happening in sort of the mainstream media's coverage of what was going on. So I think, you know, what you were doing, I think, is really important. So like sort of presenting that perspective, you know, putting this in the context of the culture and the religion for folks who didn't have the opportunity to experience that firsthand.
Right. And I think for some people who were at Standing Rock, for non-natives, it may have been the first time that they had been in a community or a tribal area where they had to learn that in tribal communities, there's not this separation of church and state, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That Native community always, the religious system is always infused in whether it's something political that's happening or something social that's happening, that religion is always there. It's always part of the community. And I think that that was something that when especially non-Indians went there, they were learning that as they went along, that, oh, okay, this is, you know, real and it's happening every day.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I'm one of those folks who was in that situation, and I feel like I got a lot of knowledge out of that experience, you know, because I saw that. I was able to see that firsthand for the first time.
One of the things that I have heard that people learn, non-natives learned, is that, you know, Native people don't separate out religion in the sense that, you know, it only exists on Sunday morning, right? It's something that happens every day. It's something that happens at sunrise and sunset, that people are much more religious. I think Native Americans are much more religious than people expect. I think that people expect it sometimes with other religions in the world. For example, you know, with Islam, people pray, you know, five times a day, right? And most people know that, right? It's kind of common understanding in America, or different religious practices in the United States that people have a common understanding of. Native American religious practice is not a common understanding. So I think that was, again, something that people learned at Standing Rock, and people who visited it, and especially like journalists who went there to cover it, thinking they were covering kind of an environmental protest or an environmental movement, and they got there and they were like, oh, wait, what? You know, people are praying all the time. Like, what's going on here? So I think that that was something that I hope is something that will become part of American understanding now, a better understanding of Native American communities.
You know, to put this in sort of a broader context, the sort of big picture narrative that I think a lot of folks have gotten out of what happened at Standing Rock was that it established this much deeper connection between the environmental movement and the indigenous rights movement. I mean, because you're sort of connected in with both of these worlds, I mean, you teach environmental studies and, you know, you also teach about Native American religion. I mean, have you seen like any of the results from this? Did this really deepen this connection between these two movements?
You know, I'm not sure when you speak of movement, the word movement. I'm not sure. I would say communities. I think that there has been a better understanding within environmental community about Native American communities. And again, the role of Native American religion as central in Native American communities. In terms of it being like a movement, in terms of like a political movement or a social movement, I think that that's a different, sorry, I'm getting all academic here. That's a little bit different than the communities themselves and the people who are in the communities. So I think that there has been a much stronger connection now between the two communities, for sure. But I think that in terms of the political movements, I think there's still kind of parallel movements that have different interests, heading in the same direction, but parallel.
Right. For sure, there are a lot of people who think of themselves as a part of this environmental community or movement that are now much more well aware of what's going on in this parallel community.
Yes.
Did you spend any time at Standing Rock?
No, I didn't. No, I was actually here in Cambridge during the entire time that people were in camp, and I don't want to use the word protest, right?
Right.
While they were there.
Did you wish that you could have the opportunity to get out there? I mean, what was sort of the thought process there?
You know, I've been involved in a lot of different political activities over the years, And just to let you know how old I am, when I was growing up, my mother, you know, and relatives had us go march with Cesar Chavez for the United Farm Workers Union. So being part of kind of political activity and political protest, I've done that for quite some time. So because of that, I didn't have the same calling or the same need that I know that other people did. And in fact, one of the commentaries I ended up writing about was that calling, which I thought was really very interesting, again, from a religious perspective. I had not thought about it until this happened with Standing Rock, but I ended up writing this commentary about the idea of pilgrimage and going to a pilgrimage site or a pilgrimage place, and how Native American / environmental protests were becoming these places of pilgrimage for young Native Americans, and, well, and Native Americans of all ages, but for Native Americans to go to participate and be part of a religious system, a religious practice. And I still think that's very interesting, that is occurring and still occurring, that when there are these larger protests that are happening. I was recently, a month ago, at the Native Nations March in Washington, D.C., and that also had a very, it had a religious foundation to that particular protest. They set up teepees on the mall, and every day they had daily prayer and nightly prayer at those teepees. They had prayer that was specifically Native American focused, but they also had interfaith prayer circles while they were there. And when they actually had, so they were there for a week before the protest happened, or the march happened. And when they had the Native Nations March, you know, it began with prayer, and it began with religious leaders taking the lead in that particular march. And I think that that's something very different and unique that is occurring now in Native American society that has not necessarily happened to this level in the past. And again, you asked previously about this kind of relationship between environmental communities and groups and Native American community. And I think we're beginning to see this at these various marches, how the environmental community is beginning to become more accepting of Native American religious practice, where they may not have been. So, for example, if an environmental march was beginning with a Christian prayer, right, or a Christian religious leader, environmental communities and environmental groups probably would not welcome that as much as they are welcoming of Native American religious practice. So I think that's just an interesting phenomenon that's happening now. And I think it's something that would be interesting for journalists to, you know, explore more, or even scholars to explore more of, you know, talking to people who are participating in these and finding out, you know, what is their own personal experience and how is this impacting them and impacting their lives.
You talked a little bit about this by bringing up this march that you participated in DC recently, but I guess I'm wondering if you can sort of elaborate, like, on a conceptual level about this connection that seems to exist between what happened at Standing Rock and the broader sort of resistance movement against Donald Trump. There's so many marches, like so many protests going on since Trump's election, and it's sort of coming on the heels of what happened at Standing Rock, which I think for a lot of people who were involved in both the environmental community and the indigenous rights community, it really felt like a milestone. And then, you know, to sort of immediately be thrust into the situation where we have to deal with this president who is, you know, sort of opposed on many levels to, like, a lot of the sort of conceptual goals that both of those communities, movements have.
So I would say a couple of things. So first of all, we need to remember the history of the United States. The United States government has always been in the business of, and I'm giving air quotes here, getting out of the Indian business. It's stated policy probably for 200 plus years that they do not want to address, they do not want to work with Native American tribes and Native American communities. And we have example after example after example where it doesn't matter who is in government. It doesn't matter if it's Democrats. It doesn't matter if it's Republicans. It doesn't matter who the president is. The stated policy always has been to either be a colonizing factor in indigenous communities' lives or to also try to deal with tribes as little as possible. It's either colonization or it's neglect. Those are kind of the two extremes that the federal government works on. So because of that, I would argue that yes, we do have a new administration. And yes, it's dramatically different than any administration we've had recently. Perhaps not in the past, but recently. But to what extent will the policy be colonization, and to what extent will the policy be neglect? We don't quite know yet, but it will be between one of those two extremes. So what I'm saying is that from a Native American community perspective, the way Native American community views the United States government is very different than the way an environmental group addresses the United States government, or even the way political parties do, because we don't think political party-wise the way Americans do. We think about ourselves as being tribal communities that have been here for millennia, and a government and a country, I'm speaking in generic terms here, that has colonized our land and our landscape. It's hard to look at any administration and feel like there's been a time or a person that has been, you know, working on behalf of tribes in the complete way that tribal governments and tribal communities would like that to happen. And shockingly, the president that has been the best president for tribes was Richard Nixon. He put in place a lot of federal policies that still exist to today that benefited tribal community, benefited tribal sovereignty, strengthened tribal government. And so, it's hard to say, you know, who is president, you know, to what extent does that really kind of benefit tribal communities? When it comes down to it, you know, tribal governments and tribal sovereignty still have to deal with the United States government as a government that is interested in their ultimate removal. And I'm speaking totally, again, from like a tribal government perspective. Uh-huh. They just, tribal governments are just like, okay, who's there? Right. Okay, how do we deal with it?
Right.
And so you got to remember that tribal governments are colonized people. Yeah. This is, America is on foreign land, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And America is, as a government, is dealing with tribes in that relationship, colonizer and colonized. So it's hard to think of it any other way.
Right. And it's going to take a lot more than one presidential candidate to have any dramatic impact on that.
From a Native American tribal government perspective, who is the Secretary of the Interior is more important than who is president. because tribes deal with the Secretary of the Interior as the representative of the United States government. And so who that person is, how they're going to implement policy, that is more important.
Right. And I think, you know, the larger issue that I think is central to this perspective that you're expressing is that Native Americans are dealing with the United States government and politicians are in power as sovereign nations, right? So, I mean, it's a very different relationship than, for example, I have politicians in power, right?
Oh, yes, or that environmental groups have.
Right.
That's why I say that when you ask the question about kind of the relationship between environmental groups and tribal community, you just have to remember that, yeah, tribes are governments, tribes are sovereign governments. Tribes have a government-to-government relationship with the United States, and environmental groups are NGOs, mm-hmm. right? And it's very different. On a very basic level or a very foundational level, they have very different relationships with the United States government. And when politicians change in the White House or in D.C., you know, that tribes adjust to that, they adapt to that. And, you know, there are some tribal people who don't vote. They don't vote in federal elections, or they don't vote in state elections because they feel like they don't want to be party to a system that is oppressing them.
So to shift topics here, how did you, I kind of want to rein this in and talk about the March for Science. And, you know, maybe there are some connections between sort of, you know, what we've been talking about and this upcoming event. But I mean, to start off, how did you get involved with the March for Science?
So the March for Science, as you know, started pretty much the day after the Women's March. People were talking on social media about doing something for science. And so within moments, it turned into this discussion of that there should be a March for Science. And so that conversation kind of snowballed, right, on social media. And within a day or two of that occurring, I contacted the folks who were the co-organizers or the co-founders and said, hey, I want to help out. I want to volunteer. And so we contacted each other. We talked on the phone. And so I became part of the National Steering Committee. So I've been involved since January when the March for Science first started. And it really, you know, it started with people just sort of saying, hey, let's do something because we saw the threat to, science as an academic endeavor, right? But also to science as something that is really important in the daily lives of all Americans. One of the things that concerned me, and this is kind of going back to Standing Rock, was the idea that within the first week of the new administration, that the president signed both a executive order to expedite environmental impact statements in development. So to me, as an environmentalist and environmental studies professor, environmental impact statements are extremely important. Reports that are important to communities, so that communities can help make decisions. But they're also something that is where you can see scientists working on the behalf of a community to provide them with information for them to make meaningful decisions in their own lives. So within the first week, the president signed that executive order. And he also, of course, signed the executive orders to expedite both the Keystone pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline. And in both of those cases, what the president was signing in the in executive orders with those is to expedite the creation of those pipelines and also to not do any kind of environmental review or to address community concerns where those pipelines were going to be built. So that's one of the main reasons that I was interested in initially volunteering for the March for Science, because I just saw that that first week, what people are saying is an anti-science right approach within the administration to address public policy issues, but also just to address issues within communities and allowing communities to have information to make, you know, choices about what's occurring in their community. Of course, since the inauguration in these last, it seems like a long time, but how many days is it now? Less than 100 days. during that time, we've also seen, for example, a potential budget that includes a over 30% cut to the Environmental Protection Agency. And as part of that, what is being cut, again, is the use of science as a tool for communities to be able to have a healthy environment within their own communities, but also to be able to make decisions. So that's how I got first involved, my concerns in terms of being involved with the March for Science.
And I wonder sort of how that's evolved over the past few months. Specifically, like, I sort of wonder, like, if you've been able to sort of inject, like, a little bit of your perspective as someone who is, you know, specifically focused on this intersection between science and religion.
So the March for Science is a day-long event, right? And a movement at this point. So when it first started, obviously it was an event that people were interested in planning. It snowballed into this huge thing on social media. I think there's over, in all the various media channels, social media channels that March for Science has, it well over a million different people are involved worldwide. When we sent out a call for volunteers, we posted it on social media. Immediately, there was 50,000 people volunteered to be part of the event. Since that time, there is a large group, actually, of people who have been working tirelessly, oh my goodness, to put on this event. There are some people who, especially the co-organizers, the co-founders, they're doing 14-hour days organizing this event and what will happen after, you know, the movement that has begun. And a lot of people who have been volunteering a lot of time to make this a success. And it's kind of amazing behind the scenes to watch how this is unfolding and what's occurring. And it's actually, I think, really, inspirational. I think it's very inspiring to watch what is occurring, because as you mentioned earlier, with the Standing Rock protest that occurred, it does feel like there is a snowball effect, right? Of people interested in civic engagement to an extent that they weren't before, an interest in being involved in the political arena that they weren't before, and really people just wanting their voice to be heard in some of these actions that are being taken now, especially at the public policy level in Washington, D.C.
You mentioned that there are plans for, you know, what happens after the March for Science. What are those plans? Maybe we can dig into that just a little bit, just so folks are aware of that this is, you know, more than just one day of action, like you said, that this is a growing movement. What do you and other folks involved with the March for Science, like, you know, what's sort of the best case outcome? Like, what do you hope will be accomplished through this event, and then what comes afterwards?
So the March for Science has plans to continue on as an organization. And in the last several months, we have written the group, I should, you know, a large number of people have written, you know, the mission statement and principles and goals of what the march is intending, one, to occur at the event, but also into the future. The March for Science has been working with groups worldwide to address this concern about science and the threat to science by not just public policy in the United States, but nation states around the world, and kind of how to strengthen that and how to address that. And so I think that it will evolve into an NGO that hopefully is an international NGO. This is me speaking. You know, I'm hoping that it does evolve into an NGO that has that becomes a major stakeholder when some of these policies are made about what happens with science, how science is funded, what is happening with data collection, data archiving, how we're looking at science as something that's important to democracy, how we're looking at science as something that is important to human health and human communities. And I think that the organization, and especially the leadership within the organization, is really kind of ready to step into that role as being an NGO that is making an impact.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, just as sort of a final note to this conversation, how can folks sort of find out more if folks are listening to this and thinking like, yeah, I want to be a part of this growing movement behind the March for Science? What can they do?
Well, first of all, go to the March for Science. So there's the March for Science is happening in Washington, D.C., but the March for Science is also happening in over 500 different communities nationwide and worldwide. Even in Antarctica, there's going to be a March for Science. Wow. On Saturday. Yes. I think there's some scientists and penguins are getting together there. But so people, I think, can begin by going to an actual march so they can meet people and they can begin to create community at one of the marches, but then also they can begin to get onto the website, which is marchforscience.com, or on the social media channels, again, so that they can meet some of the folks who are interested in this and involved in what's happening on Saturday, but then also what's going to be happening into the future.
How are Indigenous people or scientists participating in the March for Science?
So one of the things that has happened in the last month was a group of Indigenous scientists, myself included, decided to write a statement that both endorsed and supported the March for Science, but that also kind of recognizes that there is Indigenous science and that Indigenous ways of knowing are different than Western science, and that Western scientists should always take into account that Indigenous science is part of the world that we live in and is part of the, you know, knowledge production system that exists in the world today. And so because of that, we got together about a month ago, and the four people that got together were Robin Kimmerer, Melissa Nelson, Kyle White, and myself. And the four of us are all either environmental scientists, environmental studies, or environmental philosophy professors across the United States. And we wrote this statement, and we have been spending the last week asking for other Indigenous scientists and tribal community and allies to sign off, sign our statement. And so far we have, I think it's over 1,200 signatures. It's probably more than that at this point. I haven't looked lately. So the actual letter, the Indigenous science statement, is going to be something that some of the satellite marches are going to be reading it. It's going to be presented at the National March for Science. We're hoping that it actually gets read on the stage at the March for Science by someone. But if not, we're hoping that it gets shared among the scientific community, because I think it is important, kind of what you saw at Standing Rock, where you saw, again, non-natives encountering native community and sort of learning that there's a different paradigm. The society is different than probably what they expected. I think the same is true when you look at the way that Native American community approaches the natural world and the way they approach science. And again, they always have layered on top of scientific endeavor, they also have their own cosmologies, their own worldview. And that's what makes indigenous science, or what people say indigenous ways of knowing, different, because it does blend Western scientific paradigms with the cosmology and worldview of individual Native American or indigenous community. So in our statement, we address that. We wrote that, and we're just encouraging people who are scientists who work within the Western paradigm to recognize and acknowledge that the indigenous scientific methodology is also something that they should include as part of the way that they think that indigenous communities address scientific endeavor within our community.
Thank you for bringing that up and for composing that letter. I mean, that sounds fantastic. I mean, that is right up our alley. A lot of the folks who listen to this show, I think, fit within that category of scientists, biologists who, you know, maybe aren't aware of that perspective, but are, I would hope, have an open enough mind to embrace a concept like that. So that's definitely something that we can help you spread around. I'll definitely include a link to that on our show notes page and encourage folks to check that out. Thank you a lot for sharing that. And I mean, thank you for sharing your perspective on all these different issues that we addressed over the past hour in this conversation. It's been really fantastic to chat with you. So thank you for coming on the show and sharing your perspective.
Yes, thank you for having me.
All right, that was our conversation with Rosalyn Lapierre, Professor of Environmental Studies and Native American Religion at the University of Montana and Visiting Professor at the Harvard Divinity School. Rosalyn's perspective on the intersection of Western science and Native American religion is not only fascinating, but extremely important for folks of all walks of life to be aware of. There is so much misconception out there about the belief systems of indigenous communities, and Rosalyn is working hard to educate people and overcome these misconceptions. I would strongly encourage all of our listeners to read and sign Rosalyn's letter about recognizing the importance of indigenous science. You can find a link to this letter and lots of additional information about Rosalyn's research and writing, as well as the March for Science generally, on the show notes page for this episode. Those show notes can be found at wildlensinc.org/EOC118. If you enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to the show via iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or just about anywhere podcasts are found. You can also leave us an honest rating and review on iTunes if you really want to help us out and allow new people to discover the show. Just search for Eyes on Conservation in the iTunes store or follow the link on the show notes page. The Eyes on Conservation podcast is a production of Wild Lens. Today's episode was produced by myself, your host, Matt Podolsky. Our theme music is by The Humidors.